Everybody would turn their Bibles to Matthew chapter 5. I've mentioned to you two or three times how much I appreciate the opportunity to get to speak to you this week. A lesson like tonight will underscore what I'm talking about. It's really the privilege of the preacher, the speaker, not the church, in a case like this, because I have an opportunity tonight and other morning and night to try to persuade you of a truth I believe is clearly taught by the Bible, yet is needed. Many Christians are swayed away from this position for one reason or another, and some important truths are being lost because of it. This topic, I believe, is very, very important, especially as we go forward. And what we're going to look at, as I announced earlier, is we're going to be looking at Matthew 5, 20-48. And while I'm thinking about it, let me announce a couple of my upcoming topics. Tomorrow morning at 10:30, I'm still planning, Lord willing, on preaching on divorce and remarriage. And again, at the end of the sermon, we plan to have a question and answer period. So perhaps this lesson tonight, or just this evening sometime later when you get back home, you may think of some questions on the subject of divorce and remarriage. Write those down, and after the sermon tomorrow morning, I plan to try to deal with all those questions. Hopefully, Dean and I, as I said, will bring some index cards to Mark. If you think of them during the sermon tomorrow morning, you might write a question then. We'll gather them up. We'll try to deal with those after the sermon. I think that subject's very important. That's why I want to allow questions to be asked. It's too hard to get to all the issues in one sermon. So I'd like to give the basics, as I call it, the brass tacks, and then address your issues, what you think is important, or some detail you want to know about. And then tomorrow night, the title for the lesson is planned, Watering Down the Gospel. I think, well, let's think about it. Is it possible that through the years, the last few decades, that we've watered down the gospel so much and its requirements that it's really not that hard to be a Christian anymore? That the way Christians live today isn't really that much different than the world, because the things that we demand in our preaching and teaching has been watered down, diluted down so much. And I want to talk about that tomorrow night. Let's read Matthew 5, verse 20-48. For I say unto you, that except your righteousness, and of course you'll remember that Jesus is speaking here, shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment, and whosoever shall say to his brother, raketh, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of everlasting fire. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest that thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar, and go thy way. First be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Agree with thine adversary quickly, whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. And if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into everlasting fire. And if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into everlasting punishment. It hath been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you, that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery. Again, ye have heard it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shall perform unto the Lord thine oath. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, that ye resist not evil, But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain or two. Go, give to him that asketh thee, and from him that will borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless them that curse, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven, for he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? For if ye salute your brethren only, what more do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. As I mentioned earlier, and as you noticed in the reading hopefully, we have six times in this section where Jesus says, in effect, ye have heard it said by them of old time, blah, 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 but I say unto you, and so, so, so. Ye have heard it said by them of old time, but I say unto you. Six cases. I would like to examine those cases. And we want to look at the overall view, and the question we want to answer tonight, among other things, is, and this is what the controversy revolves around, in these six cases, of course we have but each time, you've heard it said, but I say to you, what is Jesus contrasting? Some say that Jesus, when he says, but I, you've heard it said by them of old time, that he's referring to false interpretations of the old law. Perhaps something that the Pharisees or the rabbis of that time were saying. And then when he says, but I say to you, that he's correcting that and giving the true interpretation of the old law. A lot of Christians believe that. A lot of preachers preach it that way. I don't believe that's the case at all. What I believe that we can establish clearly from the text is that what Jesus is doing is contrasting the Old Testament law with the New Testament law. So that when he says, you have heard it said by them of old time, he's quoting the Old Testament. Not giving a false interpretation of the Old Testament, but he's telling us what the Old Testament says. And then when he says, but I say to you, then he's giving us New Testament law. In each case, he gives the Old Testament law, then he gives his New Testament law, which I think in every case is stricter than that Old Testament law that he quotes. I believe that's what Jesus is doing, and it affects some issues that I believe are very important, how you see the text, the whole text of this passage. First of all, I'm going to move to my chart, number 20, actually, in case anybody's taking notes. Because as I put up before the sermon, you may have seen my website where you can download these charts and my sermon notes at any time you'd like to have them. But I want us to notice before we get into Matthew 5, 20 and following, and looking at it in more in detail, I want us to notice these passages that tell us that when Jesus was on earth, it was his plan, his intentions, and what he did was to preach the gospel. Even though we know that when Jesus lived on earth, he lived under the Old Testament law, didn't he? Because that Old Testament law did not pass away until he died on the cross. But what was Jesus' primary purpose in teaching while he was here? Yes, sometimes he did teach the Old Testament law. I remember one case where he told somebody who said he had cleansed of leprosy to go show himself to the priest, you know, to prove that he had been cleansed. So he told him that. That was Old Testament teaching. But for the most part, we're going to see that Jesus, in his lifetime, in his 3 years, as we think that he preached on this earth, that he's giving New Testament teaching. Let's notice some passages that might indicate that. Matthew 4:23. Jesus went about preaching the gospel. Now, that happens to be three verses before Matthew chapter 5, verse 1. And that's why I would think that when you read the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, at least as a whole, we're talking about New Testament doctrine. Jesus is, as some people say, telling us how a kingdom citizen should live. That he's not, in the Sermon on the Mount, explained to us the correct interpretation of the old law, at least not for the most part. Mark 1:14, Jesus came preaching the gospel. That sounds like he's going to give New Testament law right here, right? Luke 9:1-2 and verse 6, Jesus sent his 12 disciples to preach the kingdom of God, the gospel. Luke 16:16, the law and the prophets were proclaimed until John, that would be John the Baptist. Since that time, the gospel of the kingdom has been preached. That would indicate that John and before, they were preaching Old Testament law, but that after that, which would include Jesus, the gospel of the kingdom, the new law, the new covenant law would be taught. John 1:17, for the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. You see the contrast in what Moses brought and what Jesus brought? It doesn't seem that they're going to be teaching, at least predominantly, the same law. Jesus is not going to be teaching the law of Moses when he's on this earth, at least for the most part. Hebrews 2:3 says, how shall we escape if we neglect salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed unto us by them that heard him? The writer of the book of Hebrews is talking about salvation. How shall we neglect it? He's obviously talking about New Testament salvation. This was written decades after the New Covenant went into effect. And he said this salvation was first preached by Jesus. So Jesus was obviously then preaching New Testament law, at least predominantly, when he was on this earth. John 12:48, Jesus himself says, he that receiveth not my word hath one that judgeth him. The words that I have spoken, the same shall judge him in the last day. What are we going to be judged by in the last day, Rodney? The Old Testament law or the New Testament law? And this is Jesus is saying here, they're going to be judged based upon, we're going to be judged based upon his word. Words that he taught while he was on earth. I don't think he's talking about the law of Moses here. And John, finally, on this chart, John 14:26, but the Comforter, which is the Holy Ghost, whom the Father will send in my name, he shall teach you all things and bring all things to your remembrance, whatsoever I have said unto you. Remember, Jesus is about to leave. He's going to die on the cross, be raised from the dead, ascend up to heaven. And before he dies, practically the night before, if I'm remembering correctly, he tells the apostles, I'm going to have to leave, but I'm going to send the Holy Ghost, and he's going to remind you of the things that I taught you. If they are like me, they'd forget about 90% of it, wouldn't they, or more. So he says the Holy Ghost is going to help you with that. Well, what were they preaching later on after the Holy Ghost was there and was the Comforter and helping them and revealing to them the revelation? It was New Testament law, right? Well, part of that was going to be the things that Jesus had taught to them while he was on earth, and he was going to remind the apostles, the Holy Ghost, of what he said. Obviously, necessarily implying that what Jesus had taught them while he was on the earth is New Testament law, because that's obviously what the Holy Ghost reminded them of later. It wouldn't make any sense for him to be reminding them of the Old Testament law. Let's get into our text more specifically, though. This is where the rubber meets the road. This is how we actually prove that what Jesus is doing here is contrasting Old Testament law with New Testament law, not contrasting a true interpretation of the Old Law with a false interpretation of the Old Law, and that's by looking at each specific case and see what's actually going on. You'll see why, as I go along, why I think it's so important to understand this correctly. You'll see. First, let's look at Matthew 5:21-26. What is on the left side of the equation, as I like to call it? The side of the equation where he says, yes, heard it said by them of old time. What is it? Thou shalt not kill. Now, Gene, is that a false interpretation of the old law, or is that the old law itself? That's the old law. That's an exact quote from the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. Now, I'd like to know, how could an exact quote of the Old Testament law be a false interpretation of the old law? Now, remember, many of our preaching brethren, and I'm talking about non-institutional preachers, are saying that's exactly what's going on here. But how could an exact quote of the Old Testament law be a false interpretation of the old law? You remember the story that one preacher has told, and I don't know if it really actually true or just served as an illustration, but it makes a good point, and I've heard it repeated by many preachers down through the years. A preacher was talking to this lady about her soul, and he quoted word for word Mark 16:16, and the lady said, that's just your interpretation. Have y'all heard that illustration before? That's a good illustration, isn't it? That's only a good illustration if you agree with me that when you quote Mark 16:16, it's not a false interpretation, or it's not even an interpretation at all of Mark 16:16. Where we're saying that lady made a mistake is how could that be just his interpretation when he didn't give any comments? He just quoted the verse word for word. Haven't we always agreed through the years that's a great illustration of what goes on when we talk to denominational people about the gospel? If that illustration makes sense, then you have to agree with me on this point. When Jesus quotes the Ten Commandments, word for word, thou shalt not kill, it's impossible for that to be a false interpretation of the old law. Now, it's possible that somebody can make a false application. Somebody might look at thou shalt not kill and say, it's wrong to kill a dog, but it's okay to kill an unborn baby. That's a false application of that. You follow what I'm saying? But just quoting the verse is not a false interpretation or a false application of that. Then Jesus said, of course, he goes on to say in verse 21, he says, whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of judgment. Sometimes people say, well, where's that in the Old Testament passage? You're right, that should be in the Old Testament. Well, it is. We don't have time to look at it in depth, but do y'all remember in number 35, the story about what they're supposed to do about cities of refuge? If a man kills another man, okay? But he is claiming it was just by accident. He was supposed to flee to the city of refuge and wait. In effect, there would be a trial to try to determine if it was really an accident. If it wasn't really an accident, he was considered a murderer. And if it was an accident, then he was considered okay. But that's what that's talking about. If you'll compare that to Numbers 35, verse 12, whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. It's talking about what the man had to go through in relation to the cities of refuge. So that is actually a reference back to the Old Testament law, not some false interpretation of the old law. Now, as I said, what I'm going to suggest to you, that as we see from this first case, Jesus is contrasting Old Testament law with New Testament law, then in all six cases, that's what Jesus is doing. In each case, he quotes the Old Testament law, then he gives the New Testament law, which is stricter than the Old Testament law that he quoted. What, how does that work here? The Old Testament law says thou shalt not kill. Well, under the New Testament law, not only is it wrong to kill, but it's wrong to say to your brother, Rekha, verse 22, it's wrong to call your brother a fool, verse 22. Old Testament law is wrong to kill. New Testament law, not only is it wrong to kill, it's wrong to call him Rekha or your brother fool. One time, this was back when I was in college, I think, Rodney, we were in Tuscaloosa, I know that for a fact, it was before 86, drove over to East Columbus Church. Many of you probably know about that church in Columbus. The preacher was preaching the gospel meeting. He spent about 15 minutes explaining this verse, Matthew 5:22, at least 15 minutes, how that it wasn't wrong to call your brother a fool today. And after he got through, I looked down at that verse, and it read, whosoever shall say thy fool shall be in danger of everlasting fire. So I didn't accept what he said. Sometimes preachers will say, it's not really wrong to call somebody a fool. This verse teaches clearly it's wrong to call your brother a fool. So don't ever do it. Don't ever do it. Jesus said this wrong. It doesn't matter if some preacher can spend 15 minutes trying to explain it away. Just believe what you can read. That's how we're supposed to approach the Bible. As I said, the truth in all six cases that we're going about to go through, Jesus quotes the Old Testament, and then he presents his New Testament teaching or ethic, which is stricter than the Old Testament verse quoted. And then the next section, the next case, is Matthew 5:27-28. What is it on the left side of the equation? You have heard it said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. Is that just a false interpretation, Charlie, of the Old Testament law? It's an exact quote, again, of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not commit adultery. You know, suppose I were talking to somebody who's in an unscriptural marriage. Well, at least I thought they were in an unscriptural marriage. And so I said, I believe you're in an unscriptural marriage. And I quote them Matthew 19:9 verbatim. And this is going back to the same illustration I did in Mark 16:16. Would that just be me giving my interpretation of Matthew 19:9 if I quoted it exactly? What if he says, that's just your interpretation if I quoted Matthew 19:9 exactly and try to apply it to your situation? That wouldn't just be my interpretation if I quoted the verse exactly. Again, I know I'm repeating myself. Thou shalt not commit adultery is not a false interpretation by the Pharisees, the rabbis, the Sadducees, or anybody. It is exactly what God said in Exodus chapter 20. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Jesus said, you have heard it said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery, but I say unto you. And didn't he give a teaching that is stricter than that in verse 28? In other words, the point is this. The Old Testament says thou shalt not commit adultery. In the New Testament, not only is it wrong to commit adultery, it's wrong even if a man, for example, and it works for a woman too, if a man were to lust after a woman in his heart. I take it to mean what he's talking about is if a man, I'm getting blunt again like I did this morning, if a man were to fantasize about having relations with any woman other than his wife, then the Bible is saying he's committed adultery with her already in his heart. Do you see how that's stricter? That's stricter than just saying it's wrong to commit adultery. It's not only wrong to commit the physical adultery, it's wrong to lust after someone in your heart that's not your spouse. Now let's go to something where this really gets even more important. What's going on in Matthew 5:31-32? It has been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a right of divorcement. Is that a false interpretation of the old law? Some say that it is. You know, it's actually a quote from Deuteronomy 24:1. You probably can't see it up there, but turn in your own Bibles and let's read Deuteronomy 24:1-4. On my chart, the type is probably too small, but I simply have the King James Version up there, so turn in your Bible. Deuteronomy 24:1-4. When a man has taken a wife and married her, and it comes to pass that she find no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement. Isn't that what Jesus just said? You've heard it said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing divorcement. What's the difference in Matthew 5:31 and Deuteronomy 24:1? It's like, and this is just something that happened a debate one time that was funny. We were debating Eddie Garrett, a friend of the Baptist, riding up in Ohio, and he said, and he was saying it's something completely different subject. And he said, the difference between this and that is the difference between twiddledy-dee and twiddledy-dum. The difference between what Matthew 5:31 is saying and what Deuteronomy 24:1 is saying is the difference between twiddledy-dee and twiddledy-dum. There's no difference at all. Let me continue reading. So, let him write her the bill of divorcement, give it in her hand, send her out of his house, and when she is departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. And if the latter husband hate her and write her a bill of divorcement and giveth it in her hand and sendeth her out of his house, or if the latter husband die, which took her to be his wife, her former husband, which sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife. After that she is defiled, for that is abomination before the Lord. So Jesus in Matthew 5:31 quotes Deuteronomy 24:1, and then he gives his New Testament teaching. You see the difference? In this paragraph right below that, it says the Old Testament teaching in Deuteronomy 24:1 following was a man to divorce his wife for a reason short of fornication. Any uncleanness, a reason short of fornication. We know it wasn't fornication, because if she had committed fornication or adultery, she would have been stoned, not divorced. Recall that, Leviticus 20:10? A reason short of fornication, uncleanness, and the put away wife could remarry another. Did you notice that from verse 2? That she could go and be another man's wife? Jesus' Matthew 5:32 is totally different from that. He says, you heard it said by them of old time, let him give her a right of divorcement, but I say unto you, whoever puts away his wife saving for the cause of fornication, and again, we know the uncleanness was not limited to fornication back then, because fornication was penalized back then by stoning, not by divorce. Saving for the cause of fornication causes her to commit adultery. Whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committed adultery. So back then, the man could put away his wife for uncleanness. He could go be another man's wife. Jesus is saying under the New Testament law, no, it's stricter than that. He can only do it for fornication, if she cheats on him sexually. And then after that happens, whether it's for fornication or not, she cannot go be another man's wife. Different in Deuteronomy 24:2. Do you see, in comparing this, Matthew 5:31-32 with Deuteronomy 24, Jesus is not giving the correct interpretation of the old law. He's saying, this is what the old law taught. You've heard that. But I say to you, and he teaches what the New Testament law is going to be. Do you see that? Now, where this gets important, and I hesitate to even get into this, one of the reasons this is important is because of this new doctrine called the MMLJ doctrine. That's a pretty funny acronym, isn't it? MMLJ stands for Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And this is what some of our brethren teach us. And it's called MMLJ doctrine. And what they mean by that is all of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, none of it for us today. But it's all just Old Testament teaching. Not a bit of it. I've talked to friends who are Christians, but you know, even preached at churches where I've been. When I challenge them on this, they say even where Jesus said, except a man be born again, except a man be born of water and the Spirit, to be consistent, he was forced to say that's Old Testament teaching. To be consistent, he did that. Every bit of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is Old Testament teaching, none of it's new. You say, why would they do that? There's only one reason. There's nothing in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that they want to get rid of today except what Jesus said in Matthew 5:32, Matthew 19:9, Luke 15:18, Mark 10 about divorce and remarriage. That's the only thing they're trying to get rid of. Nothing else in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John makes any difference to them, but they're going to throw out all four books and say none of it applies today so they can be consistent and say Matthew 5:32, Matthew 19:9, Luke 16:18 doesn't apply today so you can divorce and remarry for just about any reason you want to and have as many marriages as you want to. You know, really the same point, I digress from Matthew 5, the same thing is going on in Matthew 19. There's a contrast there. Have you ever noticed that? We won't read all of the text. Perhaps we will read more of this in the morning. In Matthew 19, what goes on is the religious leaders then, I think it was the Pharisees, asked Jesus about divorce. He says, well, God has joined together, let not man put asunder. But then they have a follow-up question. In verse 7, why did then Moses command to give a writing of divorcement and put her away? That's a reference to Deuteronomy 24, verse 1. Jesus said in verse 8, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you to put away your wife, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery, and whoso marries her which is put away, doth commit adultery. You see the same contrast? Moses allowed this. The King James says suffered. A new word for that, it means allowed. Moses allowed you to do this, but I say unto you, that little word but is a contrast. We're not going to allow this anymore in the New Testament law. Same contrast as what's going on in Matthew 5:31 and 32. He quotes Moses from Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, in Matthew 5:31. Then he says in verse 32, but, contrast word, I send you. Do you see the contrast? Let me say one more point, one more thing before I move on from this point. Suppose these MMLJ doctrine guys were right, that none of this applies today, so we don't have to follow Matthew 5:32 because that was Old Testament law. Jesus just explaining the true meaning of the Old Testament law. Same in Matthew 19:9, Luke 16:18. Suppose that were true. You know what? They would still be wrong because that would get rid of those passages, but guess what you'd have left? You wouldn't be able to get a divorce for any reason, not even for fornication. Because when you examine the divorce and remarriage passages, after Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, like Romans 7, 2, and 3, that says the wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives, or 1 Corinthians 7, verse 10, says that the wife is not to depart from her husband, 1 Peter 3, 7, that says the husband is dwelled with his wife according to knowledge, they all require husband and wife to stay together until they die, and none of them even give the exception of fornication. So, far from helping them, if you threw out Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it wouldn't help them. It would make God's divorce and remarriage law even stricter. You couldn't get a divorce for any cause, not even fornication. But, of course, that's not what they're interested in. They're just interested in throwing out Matthew 19:9, Matthew 5:32, and then they assert then, and I'm talking about brethren, that you can get a divorce for just any reason, because Matthew 19 and Matthew 5, they don't apply today. That was just Jesus giving Old Testament law. You see their motivation? We should never let motivation dictate what the text is going to say. Find out what the text says, or I should say text plural, what they say, and then believe that, apply that, require that, let the chips fall where they may. Don't start out with what you want to believe and try to make the text that you're looking at fit that. Start out by looking at the text, let them say what they actually say in context, and then you believe and take a position on that. If that's hard, believe it. If it's easy, believe that. It doesn't make any difference. It's what God says. Let's notice, while we're on the topic of divorce and remarriage, I consider this very important, obviously. I want you to notice a more complete list. I doubt it's exhaustive, but a more complete list of the differences between the Old Testament law on divorce and remarriage and the New Testament law, what Jesus was teaching. Just to show you that Jesus is not just reiterating the Old Testament law on divorce and remarriage. And you know, us being Christians, we all know that the old law is not in effect today, right? But it seems like people forget that when they want to justify people in unscriptural marriages. Here's on the left side of this chart is Moses' MDR teaching, marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And on the right side is Jesus' teaching on divorce and remarriage. For example, in the Old Testament, you could get a divorce for any uncleanness. In the New Testament, only for fornication. You know, in Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, they could only get a divorce for uncleanness. But that was talking about if an Israelite was married to another Israelite woman. Sometimes, Israelite men got wives when they captured a country, and they took a wife, and they had what they called, in this text, a captive wife. Did you know, if you look at Deuteronomy 24, 21, that a man in that case, an Israelite, could divorce a foreign wife simply based upon the fact that he had no delight in her? Better watch that, Jenny. If he had no delight in her, she didn't have to commit any uncleanness at all. Just if he had no delight in her, he could divorce her. I'm talking about if this Israelite man was married to a woman of a different nationality. Do you follow what I'm saying? The New Testament is still only for fornication. If I were to marry somebody from a different country, or even if I were to marry somebody who's not a Christian, which I believe is wrong, we'll talk about that later in the week, I can only divorce her for fornication. Another thing that we've already mentioned from Leviticus 20, verse 10, and one or two other passages is that if a woman committed adultery, a wife, she was stoned. In the New Testament, the adulteress is not to be stoned, but she can be divorced. You see that difference? Under the Old Testament, as we read in Deuteronomy 24, verse 2, that woman who's put away, it says she may go be another man's wife. We've already pointed out from Matthew 5:32, the second part of that verse. We can see it from the second part of Matthew 19:9 and also Luke 16:18b, that divorcee may not remarry. A couple other differences. In the Old Testament, polygamy was allowed, and there's some passages that show that. Under the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 7:2 says that's not allowed. Under the Old Testament, I think we'll all remember that, this one, because it's highlighted by Jesus in Matthew 22 when he's arguing with, I think, the Sadducees over whether or not there's a resurrection. They bring the hard case of this woman who's married to a man, and he dies, leaves no seed, so she marries a brother, having seven times. Whose wife will she be in the judgment, or in the resurrection, in the afterlife, as we would call it? Well, what did the Old Testament taught? It taught that if a brother died without any children, then the next younger brother, another brother, would be supposed to marry his former wife to bring up seed. That was in the Old Testament. Have you ever read that in the New Testament? Does anybody here think that's required? Then you understand and agree with me that Jesus' teaching on divorce and remarriage is not the same as the law of Moses taught on divorce and remarriage. And this confirms that Matthew 5, 21 through 48 is all about a contrast between the Old Testament law and the New Testament law. Not a contrast between a false interpretation of the old law versus a true interpretation of the old law. Let me move on to the next section. Matthew 5, beginning in verse 33. We've already read it. What's on the left side of the equation? You have heard it been said, thou shalt not forswear thyself. But I say that you swear not at all. This text also is another reason why I think it's so important to understand what's going on in this whole section. When I first was converted, became a Christian, in 1981, of course, I was pretty sheltered, right? You were sheltered a little bit yourself. I didn't know a single Christian that thought it was right to swear. And I'm talking about like this thing in a courtroom or other very important places. Now I see preachers preaching in the Brotherhood magazines, gospel meetings. A lot of preachers, a lot of Christians believe it's okay to swear in the court of law. Well, perhaps a lot of them did back then, and I just didn't know them. But look at this text. You have heard it said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself. Or the New King James says, you should have heard it said, you shall not swear falsely. Well, the New King James version of Leviticus 19:12 is, ye shall not swear by my name falsely. Can you see that's a quote? That in Matthew 5:33, Jesus is quoting Leviticus 19, verse 12. And notice from these other passages, that is really the teaching of the Old Testament law. Thou shalt not forswear thyself. That means that if you swear you're going to do something, you better do it. If you swear you're going to do something and you don't do it, then you have swore falsely and you committed sin. I'm talking about the Old Testament law. But if you swore you were going to do something and you did do it, then you're fine and dandy. Notice Numbers 30, verse 2. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word, he shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth. What does that say? Same as Leviticus 19:12. If you swear you do something, you're going to do something, better do it. If you don't, it's a sin. But it's not saying it was wrong to swear to begin with. You see that? Psalm 15:1-4. Lord, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? In other words, who's approved of God? He who that swears to his own hurt, detriment, and changeth not. Same teaching in the Old Testament. The one that's going to be acceptable to God is the one that swears, and when he swears he's going to do it, he does it. There's a list of two or three more passages up there that teach the same thing in the Old Testament. But is that what Jesus teaches? Does Jesus say, if you swear, you better do it? No, he says, you've heard it said by them of old time, in effect, if you swear, you better do it. But I say unto you, swear not at all. That's as plain as day. How can so many Christians think that it's okay to swear when Jesus says, swear not at all? You remember I mentioned in this morning's lesson about 1 Corinthians 14:34-35 being so clear, maybe perhaps the clearest verse on any topic in the Bible, and have Bible studies with people, and every one of them can see it. None of them thinks it's vague or anything. This is not vague. This is almost as clear as 1 Corinthians 14:34-35. Yet we have a lot of our brethren that say it's okay to swear. They say all that Jesus is condemning here is forswearing myself, you know, making frivolous oaths. But that doesn't make any sense. If you have that, you don't have any contrast. That would be Jesus saying, you have heard it said by them of old time, you shall not forswear thyself. But I say unto you, don't forswear thyself. Do you see how that would make any sense? There's a contrast going on here. Jesus said, in the Old Testament, don't forswear thyself. In other words, if you swear to do it, you better do it. The New Testament is, don't even swear to start with. I say that's pretty clear. Let me give you some illustrations using this word at all, this phrase at all, since it says swear not at all. My wife, perhaps punishing our kids. You can't watch television at all today. Not Andy Griffith, or Monday Night Football. I just want you to pass the time by reading a book. Does that sound like she means that some TV is going to be allowed? Doesn't sound like it to me. She says, you can't watch television at all tonight. Not even Andy Griffith or football. Two fairly clean shows. She said, not at all. So if Josh is caught watching TV, he's probably going to get a spanking. What about these Bible illustrations? John 18:38. Pilate said unto him, what is truth? And when he said this, he went out again unto the Jews and said unto him, I find in him, talking about Jesus, no fault at all. Did that mean he found one or two faults in Jesus? But not very many? No, it meant he found no fault at all. There was no fault at all in Jesus. Period. Zero. What about 1 John 1:5? This then is the message which we have heard of him and declare to you, that God is light and in him is no darkness at all. Does that mean there's a little bit of darkness in God? You know, darkness here is representing sin. Just a little sin in God, but not enough to notice. Is that what that means? Just no darkness at all. Just a little bit of darkness, but not enough to notice, you know? Not anything major. That's not what that means. No darkness or sin at all means none whatsoever. Not even a hair. And so when Jesus tells us to swear not at all, why can't we understand that means swear not at all? None. If you swear even in the court of law, it's wrong. You're violating Jesus' teachings. Brethren, let's not compromise on that. There's no reason to. And you'll remember, there's another passage that confirms this in the Bible. James 5 verse 12, my brethren, swear not. Neither by heaven, neither by the earth. We'll just swear a little bit every now and then. But let your yea be yea and your nay nay. No, that's not what he said. Swear not, neither by this, neither by that, nor by any other oath. Sometimes people say, oh, that just means you can't swear by heaven or by earth. He says, don't swear by those, neither by any other oath. It's like God anticipated with these two verses that people were going to say it's okay to swear under some situations. And he says, no, swear not at all. Don't swear with any oath. I ask you, if God had wanted to teach that we're not to swear any, ever, not even in a court of law, how could he have said it to make it any more clear than these two verses? Now let me get back, because I think this is very clear on swearing. Let me get back to my whole section here, Matthew 5, 20-48. Any interpretation of that whole section that makes it right to swear, any line of reasoning on that whole section that would make it right to swear, you can know that line of reasoning is incorrect. See, that's what they're doing. They're saying, well, Jesus has just explained the true meaning of the old law, and the true meaning of the old law is that if you swear, you better do it. You better not swear thyself. But it's okay to swear, say in the court of law, if you really are telling the truth, you can know for a fact the line of reasoning on the whole section must be wrong, because the conclusion from the line of reasoning on the whole section was it was okay to swear, and Jesus said, swear not at all, nor by any other oath. Then the next section, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Sometimes we might be a little more loving than God is, and we say, oh, that's nowhere in the Bible. The Bible never taught an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That's too hard. That's an exact quote of Exodus 21:24 and Leviticus 24:20. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Again, I ask you, friends, brethren, how can an exact quote of an Old Testament verse be a false interpretation of Old Testament teaching? If it can be, then that illustration we've been using through the years about the preacher asking the woman and saying, what do you think about he that believes that is baptized shall be saved? And she says, that's just your interpretation. We're going to have to quit using that illustration because the woman is right. It was just his interpretation, even though he quoted the verse without giving any comment. The woman was right. No, an exact quote of Exodus 21:24 is not a false interpretation of that passage. Now, many brethren like to try to get around what this says. You notice it says, one eye for an eye, two for two, but I say to you, resist not evil, but whosoever smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. In other words, turn the other cheek. Many brethren like to get around this by saying, this is only talking about personal vengeance. Personal vengeance. I didn't read that in there, did you? You know why they want to say that? It's so that they can get vengeance as long as they call it non-personal vengeance. But I didn't read anything about personal vengeance there. Maybe it is talking about it, maybe it's not. But they just wasn't in the text. This is talking about personal vengeance, impersonal vengeance, both of those, any violence. But it would include personal vengeance, and in doing that, as I have in my notes up here, it stands in direct contrast to the revenger of blood instructions that we talked about from Numbers 35. You remember where, say somebody killed my brother, but he claims it's an accident, I can go try to follow him and get revenge and kill him. But he flees to the city of refuge, and he's protected there while we try to figure out whether or not it was an accident, and I can't touch him while he's in there. That would have been personal vengeance if I caught him out of the city of refuge and killed him in retribution because he killed my brother, right? Isn't this contrast to that? Isn't this that I can't do that? I can't take vengeance on him? I've got to turn the other cheek? You remember Romans 12, verse 17? Recompense no man, to no man, evil for evil. That's an absolute. That's an absolute. Recompense to no man, evil for evil. Jesus' new law, the New Testament law, never authorizes an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But the Old Testament law certainly did say that. And then the last section, on the left side of the equation, you have heard it said by them of old time, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thy enemy. But I say you love even your enemies, basically. That, love thy neighbor, as you probably know, is an exact quote from the Old Testament law, Leviticus 19:18. Then our brethren will say, well, Pat, you've got to be wrong about everything you're saying because the Old Testament never said to hate your enemy. And they just say that and everybody assumes that they're true. But did you know the Old Testament did teach they were to hate their enemies under certain circumstances? Here, I've got a list of verses up here. Here's my little pointer. We'll do it. Here's Deuteronomy 23, Psalm 26. Here's some more that taught in the Old Testament they were to hate their enemies under certain circumstances. The one quote I have up there on the chart is, I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. Doesn't that talk about hating your enemies there? It certainly does to me. What are you talking about, hating your enemies? Weren't they supposed to love their neighbor and things like that? Notice my notes. I want you to consider that the Israelites were told by God to destroy other nations in war, even obliterate the women and children at times. I suggest to you that this is not hate, that this is hate in action, not hate in feeling. What do you mean by that? Well, you see this a number of times in the Bible. For example, in Proverbs 13:24, the Bible says, "He that spareth his rod hateth his son." Does that mean when the dad doesn't spank his child like he ought to, that mean he has this hate, a feeling of hate toward his son? No, probably he has this feeling of love toward his son, and he's having a hard time bringing himself to spank his son. The feeling is love. The feeling is affection. But he lets that get the best of him, and the Bible calls it hate. It's not the feeling that's hate. It's hate in action. You see what I'm saying? Now, think about that concept. When the Israelites were told to go and obliterate this nation, including the women and children, that wasn't hate in feeling, but it sure was hate in action, wasn't it? You see that? Compare these two passages right here. This is what the Old Testament they were told to do, and here's what we're told in the New Testament. Compare them to see if they're not different. 1 Samuel 15, verse 3, and then verse 33. "Go and smite Amalek, and utterly destroy all that they have, and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling." Samuel said, "As thy sword hath made women childless," I skipped a little bit there, "so shall thy mother be childless among women." And Samuel hewed Agag in pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. Now, compare that to what Jesus said in Matthew 5 in our text that we're looking at, verse 44. "Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you." Can you see just a teensy bit of difference there? The Old Testament law is being contrasted with the New Testament law. Why is this important? I believe this is important because it gets back to the war question. When you fellas registered, I had to register for the draft when I was 18. You did the same, Rodney? Did you register? How did you register? Conscience of objector?
I sure did.
I didn't. I was a Baptist back then, so I never registered that way, but that's the way I believe now. We know most of our brethren don't believe you need to register as a conscientious objector. As a matter of fact, if you hear what they're saying and what they're writing, they're all the time talking about how that we need to beat this country in war, this, that, or the other, and all of that. And we call that issue the war question. But I would suspect, don't want you to answer out loud, I would suspect my like Bryce Freeman was a conscientious objector. Probably many of the men here have been through the years. They would agree with me on this issue. That's not really important. I'm just illustrating what I'm saying. The number one argument, by far the number one argument to say that we as Christians can fight in war for our country today is that in the Old Testament they did it. Well, didn't they? The Israelites would go out, and even though they had a law that said don't kill, thou shalt not kill in the Ten Commandments, didn't Samuel hew Agag in pieces? They would go out and fight in war. Didn't David throw a stone with his slingshot at Goliath and kill him? Don't we have many examples of Israelites fighting in war? And God actually told them to do it. That's the number one argument today for why Christians can go fight in war for the United States. They did it in the Old Testament. Again, we as Christians, we debate the subject of Adventists. We even have to debate the Baptists out of this issue about we're not under the Old Testament law anymore. We should be the ones to know that you don't find authority for what you're doing in the Old Testament law. Think instrumental music. Just about anything else you can think of, they try to find authority in the Old Testament. We teach them right on that. Yet here we are trying to find authority for fighting in war for our country from the Old Testament law. The contrast in Matthew 5, beginning in about verse 42, down through the end of the chapter, is basically this. In the Old Testament, you were to love your neighbor, the Israelite brethren, but you were to hate your enemy, meaning you were to go wipe them out off the planet. He says, in the New Testament, it's not going to be that way anymore. Not only are you supposed to love your neighbor, but it's going to be even stricter than that. You're supposed to love your enemy. You're supposed to do good to him. You see, Jesus is, in my view, specifically saying that argument that they did it in the Old Testament won't work anymore. Because on this point, the Old Testament and the New Testament are different. Oh, many points. Most points, as a matter of fact, Old Testament and New Testament are the same. Like, for example, both covenants said, don't steal. That's the thing. But sometimes things are different, and here's one of the cases. The Old Testament says, authorized. Commanded, not just authorized, not just allowed, but commanded. Go out and kill your enemy. The New Testament says, you can't do that. Instead, you're to love him. You're to bless them that curse you. Pray for them that despitefully use you. Do good to them that hate you. Do you see the contrast between the Old Testament law and the New Testament law? And as I said, this dismisses the number one argument that brethren are making that says that Christians can go out and fight for their country in war. This takes it away. Understanding the truth on this whole section that in all six cases, Jesus is contrasting Old Testament law and New Testament law. Hate for enemies, like participating in national carnal warfare, should be replaced with love. I know I'm over time. Let me present one or two arguments that people make when they try to claim that this section is talking about a correction of false interpretation of the old law. Number one, they say, well, Jesus said you should not commit adultery, but I say don't lust after a woman. But didn't the Old Testament teach that we shouldn't lust in passages like Proverbs 6:25 and Job 31:1? Yes, it did. And that's where I get back to this point that I've already made. The Old Testament and New Testament overlap in many cases. So when Jesus is contrasting giving Old Testament law, then he gives New Testament law, we should expect that sometimes the New Testament law is going to overlap with Old Testament law. Didn't we learn this in our debate with Seventh-day Adventists? For example, when we're debating them, we say the Ten Commandments are gone, and so we don't have to keep the Sabbath anymore. The first argument is always this. That means it's okay to kill and steal today. And we say, no, the New Testament teaches that. We're recognizing the fact that the Old Testament law and the New Testament law are the same on some things. Many things. Probably the majority of things. He said, but how can that be so in this case when there's a contrast going on? Well, notice these couple of illustrations I have to help you understand that. John 1:17, which we've already read, maybe on the first part I brought up, says, the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. In that contrast, the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. Does that mean the old law didn't have any grace and truth? Well, it had a lot of truth in it. It was the truth back then, and it had a lot of grace in it too. You see what I'm saying? So there's a contrast going on between the old law and the new law, but still there's some overlap there, isn't there? Same thing in Hebrews 10:28-29. That contrasts physical death as a punishment for sin under Moses' law versus spiritual death as being much worse, sower, as the King James says, under our law. But wasn't there also spiritual death in the Old Testament law? Sure there was. So just because we have a contrast doesn't mean they're going to be completely mutually exclusive. So we have six cases here. What's going on here? Here's examples of Matthew 5 principles which are true under both covenants. In verse 22, where it talks about how you should treat your brethren, the prohibition against mistreatment of brethren. That would be the same in the Old Testament and New Testament. In the Old Testament, they were not to mistreat their brethren. In the New Testament, we're not to mistreat our brethren. Verse 28, sexual lust. The Old Testament, that was wrong. New Testament, that was wrong. Verse 29 and 30, when it talks about it's better to lose your hand or your eye than to sin. The Old Testament, in fact, taught that same idea. Serving God is more important than the eye or the hand. In the Old Testament, that was true. In the New Testament, that was true. Okay? Now, if all we have was those three things in this section, we might think, well, Jesus is giving Old Testament law. We might think that. But, as I said, the distinction is made in the other sections where they're different. For example, the differences in Matthew 5:31-32 on divorce and remarriage, they're clearly different in the yet heard it said by them of old time in what I saw in you. Clearly different Old Testament and New Testament law. The law of divorce and remarriage is different today than the New Testament than the Old Testament law. And swearing is clearly different. Back then it was right to swear, but if you swore to do something, you better do it. New Testament, swear not at all. Do you see that? So the thing that fits this whole thing is that Jesus is contrasting Old Testament law and New Testament law. And then I ask the question, out of all cases, isn't Jesus teaching New Testament law in each case? Yes, some of them would also have been taught in the old, but isn't he teaching New Testament law on the right-hand side of the equation? Isn't it wrong today to mistreat your brother? No sexual lust, right? That's New Testament law. Divorce only for fornication, Matthew 5:32. That's New Testament law. Don't swear. That's New Testament law. Resist not evil. That's New Testament law. Love your enemies. That's New Testament law. And then here's another argument made. They say, this has got to be talking about, when Jesus said, you've heard it said by them of old time, that's got to be talking about a false interpretation of the old law because it uses the word said, not written. In other words, Jesus didn't ever say it out of those six times. He never said, you see that it was written by them of old time. It was always said. So it must be talking about false interpretations, what people are saying about the old law. People make that argument, but on other topics, they're not consistent on that. For example, Luke 4:12, when Jesus was being tempted by the devil, it says, and Jesus said unto him, it is said, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. But you know, the parallel account of that, Matthew 4, where the same three temptations are going on, Jesus said, it is written again, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. And both of them are a quote from Deuteronomy 6, verse 16. It is very common for the New Testament writers, including Jesus, to say something was said, and they're talking about something that was said in the Old Testament, what was written. And he uses the word said, but that's very common. Mark 7, verse 10, for Moses said, honor thy father and thy mother, and whoso curseth father and mother, let him die to death. What is this? The word said. Does that mean it has to be something that somebody said during his day? No, that's a quote of Exodus 20, verse 12, the Ten Commandments, and 21:17. Even though he said, he didn't say written. As a matter of fact, it's actually more common for the New Testament writers to say somebody in the Old Testament said something than to say it was written. Even though they're quoting the Old Testament law, it's actually more common for them to use the term said than written. And most of our brethren know that, yet they still make this argument. James 2:11, it says, for he that said, do not commit adultery, said also, do not kill. Why do we know that he's quoting the Old Testament law here, even though he used the word said, but we don't understand that in Matthew 5 because he used the word said? Doesn't that seem a little inconsistent? And then one other point on this. I don't know that he does this in all cases, but he doesn't just say, you have heard it said. Most of the time, it seems like he says, you have heard it said by them of old time. You know, the position is that Jesus is just correcting false interpretations of the law in his day. Well, if they were false interpretations of the old law in his day, he wouldn't have said, you have heard it said by them of old time. He should have said, you have heard it said by them recently. Or you have heard it said by them in new time. But he said, you have heard it said by them of old time. Let me give you some examples of that phrase in the Bible. Acts 15:21, the Bible says, for Moses said, of old time. It uses the word said, but it says Moses said of old time. That was old time compared to Acts 15, wasn't it? It had been centuries before. 1 Peter 3:5-6, in the old time, the holy women being in subjection to their own husbands, even as Sarah obeyed Abraham. The old time is referring back to centuries before, not during the time that was written, right? Not recent time. 2 Peter 1:21, for the prophecy came not in old time by the will of man, but holy men spake of God, spake as they were moved by the Holy Ghost. When is that old time referring to? When was that? Did that prophecy come? During that time? The recent time? No, that is centuries before. That's what people mean by old time. So when it says in Matthew 5, you have heard it said by them of old time, he's not talking about the false interpretation of the religious leaders of his day, like the Pharisees, and he did correct them, we know, on their false teaching during his day. But he's not talking about that. He's talking about what somebody has said, what Moses has said, in old time. He quotes Moses, perhaps all six times, but I know he quotes the Old Testament all six times. There's an important principle here to understand, because the other side makes this point. How could Matthew 5, 32 and 19:9, and I'm focusing on the divorce and remarriage text, because that's really what they're getting at. They're really getting at that. How could that apply today, since when Jesus said them, the Old Testament law was in effect. And that's true. When Jesus said Matthew 5:32 in Matthew 19:9, the Old Testament law was still in effect at that time. But here's something they don't think about, evidently, on the other side of the coin. When Matthew 5:32 and Matthew 19:9 were written for us by the Apostle Matthew, it was decades after the Old Testament was gone and the New Testament was in effect. That's a more important point. Not, there was only a few people there, probably, when Jesus said these things, but there have been millions and perhaps billions that these texts were intended for when they were put in the Bible some decades later when Matthew wrote them. That's much more important. When were they written? Decades after the New Testament was in effect. Now, what I'm doing on this chart is explaining, though, how Jesus could say those things and there be New Testament law when the Old Testament law was still in effect. And that's a term that our brethren have used for years, and I like the term. It's called preparatory teaching. Preparatory teaching. Here's how that works. Suppose, for example, y'all remember in England, we've heard, I've never been over there, some of you probably have, they drive on the left side of the road. We drive on the right. Suppose the United States decided they wanted everybody to drive on the left side of the road. Do you think they would just make that decision and just spring it on everybody right in 1 second and send out the policemen to give everybody tickets without even warning them? No, I think what they might do is they could probably do something like this. See, we're in May right now. June. They might say something like this. We think it's better for everybody to drive on the left side of the road, like those Englishers, as Ernest T. Bass would call them. So what we're going to do, starting at midnight on January 1st, we're all, you know, in 6 months from now, about, we're going to all start driving on the left side of the road. And then they might put signs up and things in the newspaper. Starting on January 1st, we're all going to start driving on the left side of the road. They would be warning us about some law that was coming up that wasn't in effect at the time they told us, right? Preparatory teaching. You see what I'm saying? They're telling us what the law is going to be ahead of time so we can get ready for it. Does it make sense that Jesus, remember we read all those passages that said he came to preach the gospel, that while he was on earth, since he came to institute the New Testament law, that he would spend a good part of his time teaching what the New Testament law was going to be? Like, starting on the day of Pentecost, a year or two later, even though the Old Testament law was still in effect. I don't know how many of you play golf here. Gene said he played a little bit, but Gene, did you notice in the newspapers that they're going to outlaw the, what is that called? Oh, the no anchor putting. And I'll try to explain it to you, but there's a new way of putting that the men are doing is they have this long putter. And the long putter is not going to be outlawed, but some of them have been putting it up against their chest so that the top of the putter doesn't move at all when they do this. It's called anchor putting. So the PGA decided that they should make that against the rule. The way Tiger put it, that everybody, all the clubs should have to swing the club, all of them need in the putter. So if you have a long putter, short putter, you still will have to anchor that top of that putter in your chest. You've got to break it down so you have to swing with both hands. They're going to make anchor putting against the rules starting in the year 2016. And that's to give the ones who use that style time to get ready, time to change, and to practice, and to get ready to have to change over to the new rules. You see what I'm saying? Wouldn't that be preparatory teaching? It's still okay for this year, 2014, 2015, to do anchor putting, but you better get ready. In 2016, you can't do that anymore. You see what I'm saying? That's exactly what Jesus was doing. Let me give you some clear examples of this in the Bible. Turn to Matthew 24. Now, Matthew 24, in this section, verses 17 and 18, Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem that's going to come, as we know now from history, in 70 A.D. So about 35 to 40 years in the future from what he said. So notice Matthew 24, verse 17. He's talking about this calamity that's going to come in 35 to 40 years. He says, Jesus said, "Let him that which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house, neither let him that which is in the field return back to take his clothes." The point of this is that 35 or 40 years from now, though he doesn't tell the date, when you see the abomination of desolation, Titus's army
you get out of that city. Don't even take time to go back to your house to get some stuff. Get out quick, because if Titus gets there, and as we know from history, he sees the city, and you're trapped in that crowd in that city, in the siege, it's not going to be good news. So you get out when you see it coming. Get out quick. In this perfect example of preparatory teaching, he didn't mean for those right there when he said it, when he was teaching this, that everybody's on the housetop, I want you right now to come down and don't get anything out of your house. If you're in the field, leave, don't return back to your house. No, he's talking about when you see Titus and his army 35 or 40 years from now. Preparatory teaching. And then notice one that we're more familiar with, Matthew 18:17. Remember verses 15 through 17, Jesus is teaching what to do if a brother sins against you. He says, go to him and him alone. The assumption is nobody else knows about the sin, and you're supposed to try to keep it as private as possible. Don't announce it to the world. Maybe he'll repent, and nobody else needs to know about it. He won't hear you. Take it in two or three. Notice what he says in verse 17. And if you neglect to hear them, tell it unto the church. But if you neglect to hear the church, let him to be unto thee as a heathen man and a publican. When did the church start? The church didn't start probably the day of Pentecost. Remember, in Matthew 16, Jesus said, I will build my church in the future. The church was not in existence when Jesus said this. And he says, if you take these two or three, and he won't hear you, tell it to the church. He's telling us what to do today, how to withdraw from people. But he didn't apply when he said it. The church wasn't even in existence at that time. Preparatory teaching. You know, Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper in Matthew 26:26-29, and two or three more parallel passages. What law was in effect when he instituted the Lord's Supper? Old Testament law. Was he teaching them how to eat the Lord's Supper every first day of the week then? No. He instituted the Lord's Supper, and we find out in the New Testament we eat that every first day of the week in the church. He instituted it then, but it was preparatory teaching. It didn't apply then. It applied later. That Jesus' primary thing that he did in teaching was to usher in the New Testament law and tell them what it was going to be like. Both Matthew 19:9 and Matthew 5:32, actually verses 8 and 9, 31 and 32, show that Jesus is contrasting his teaching with the law of Moses on NBR. So since there's a contrast, he must have been instituting New Testament law. When we talk about the MMLJ doctrine, the whole basis for the MMLJ doctrine is that there can be no such thing as preparatory teaching. Since Jesus taught it then when he was on this earth, it had to apply right then. It's impossible for there to be such a thing as preparatory teaching. No. The reason we know much of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John does apply today because there is such a thing as preparatory teaching. Final chart. Let's go back and try to determine again what the contrast is in the whole section. Now, even the people that disagree with me and say that Jesus is quoting false interpretations of the old law, and he's giving true interpretation of the old law, or perhaps he's giving false interpretations of the old law and he's giving New Testament law, they're going to have to agree on what I'm about to show. So let's look at it. Here we have on the left side, the ye have heard, but I say unto you. And there's verse 21 and following, the six cases. In the six cases, let's fill out the blank. Is Jesus quoting Old Testament in the left side of the equation, ye have heard? Verse 21, thou shalt not kill. Verse 27, thou shalt not commit adultery. Verse 31, let him give her a right in divorce. Quoted Deuteronomy 24:1. 33, thou shalt not forswear thyself. 38, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. 43, love your enemies. Yes, in every case he's quoting the Old Testament law. Now you may speculate that somehow he's giving false interpretations of the old law, but you have to admit he's quoting the Old Testament law in all six cases. What about on the right side of the equation? Is it, in all six cases, is he teaching truth that's equal or consistent with New Testament law when he says, but I say unto you? Now you may speculate that he's giving a true interpretation of the old law, but you have to admit, in all six cases, what is teaching on the right side of the equation is consistent with New Testament law. Everybody has to admit that. Verse 21, don't hate your brother without a cause. Doesn't the New Testament law teach that? Verse 27, don't lust. I meant verse 28.
Does it the New Testament law teach that? Verse 32, divorce only for fornication. Doesn't the New Testament law teach that? Swear not at all. Doesn't the New Testament teach that? Regardless of what you believe about that, whether or not you really accept it, literally, we know that's New Testament law. Verse 38, turn the other cheek. Isn't that New Testament law? Everybody would admit that. Verse 43, love your enemies. Isn't that consistent with New Testament law? Everybody would admit that. Everybody admits that in all six cases, Jesus quotes the Old Testament law on the left side of the equation, you have heard it said, and on the right side of the equation, but I say to you, he's giving teaching that's consistent with New Testament law. If that's the case, if everybody agrees with that, then what would the contrast be? It would be a contrast with a quote from the Old Testament law with the New Testament law that is stricter than that. And if you say anything beyond that, you're just speculating. Again, why is this important? Because the brethren are teaching the other way. Not all of them are doing all of this, but the 3 points that one or the other, some of them are getting at, is they want to teach something different on divorce and remarriage, something much looser. They want to teach that it's okay to swear in a court of law and other very important cases, as long as you don't do it frivolously. And they want to teach it's okay for a Christian to fight in war for his country. That's why they're doing this. And they're wrong because they got the contrast wrong. In all six cases, Jesus is contrasting Old Testament law with New Testament law. And that proves that the only reason we can get a divorce is for fornication. We can never swear. And it's a sin to kill for our country. At this time, we're going to stop.